This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. In the midst of two viruses that are disproportionately shattering black and brown communities and wreaking havoc on the working class, COVID-19 and racist policing, we're looking for bold policies to achieve economic and racial justice, and to think this through with us is William Darity, professor of public policy, African and African American studies, and economics, and the director of the Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University.
Professor Darity has served as chair of the Department of African and African American Studies and was the founding director of the Research Network on Racial and Ethnic Inequality at Duke, and reminds that when slavery ended, the disenfranchisement of African Americans did not. Discrimination continued in jobs, housing, education, barriers that have contributed to the staggering inequality that persists in the country today, and consequently makes the case for reparations as an answer to closing the racial wealth gap.
And I'm so pleased to be joined by Professor William Darity.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, I want to begin with the best of times and the worst of times. It's hard for me to think of it as the best of times, but we can get there. But the worst of times. All of this seems to be characterized by a longstanding pattern of structural racial inequality that now it has deepened further as a result of the economic downturn, which is close to depression levels with the advent of the pandemic. But, sir, how do you evaluate this period of time economically and particularly for people of African ancestry?
This period of time is particularly brutal. There's been no joyous moment in American history for black people, but this is an especially difficult time, in part because people are either confronted to a large extent with job loss as a consequence of being in a disproportionate number of occupations that require personal service and personal care. And those are jobs that have been eliminated as a consequence of the pandemic, unless they are jobs that are identified as essential. But for individuals who are holding such jobs, again, disproportionately people who are black, they are continuing to work, but they're working in an environment where they risk a high degree of exposure to the disease. And so either you lose your job, or you're at high risk of infection. So that's one dimension of what's going wrong. In the process of losing employment, you lose income. This means that you are likely to lose access to medical insurance, but it also means a sharp reduction in your personal income and leaves people vulnerable to a host of calamities, including food insecurity and eviction from their residences. And so I think this is a especially hard time. It's also reflected in the fact that the estimates that I have seen from research, like the work that's been done by the economist Robert Farley, is that close to one half of all black-owned businesses have gone out of operation, at least on a temporary basis. So this has been a staggering hit to a community that already was starting at a sharp disadvantage.
Professor Darity, you've called for an economic bill of rights for workers, which includes a federal jobs guarantee, and this is sort of reminiscent of what FDR was asking for in his final days in office, and also of the demands from the March on Washington in 1963. Could you expand on your proposal?
Federal job guarantee would be an assurance of employment for all adult Americans. It would be an assurance of employment that would involve the provision of a salary that would at least be above the poverty rate or the poverty line, as well as a benefits package that would be comparable to the benefits that are available to all federal civil servants. So this would be inclusive of a medical insurance package. It would mean that every American could be freed of the fear of unemployment. and the threat of unemployment would be removed altogether. It also would mean that we would set an effective floor on the compensation that goes to all workers, because the private sector wouldn't be able to hire anyone unless they at least matched the minimum compensation that was offered through the federal job guarantee. And this would be a more effective floor on compensation than, say, exclusively a minimum wage or a living wage law. And this is because your minimum wage or your effective wage is zero if you do not have a job. But it's also because minimum wage and living wage laws do not mandate a sufficient number of hours to ensure that everybody receives an appropriate benefits package. So there's some sharp advantages from the standpoint of well-being of the population at large from having a federal job guarantee.
In much of what you've written that I have read, you describe blacks as in a perpetual state of unemployment crisis that, of course, deepens astronomically during national economic turndowns. And you also talk about the disparity in terms of the wealth the median Latino and black household would have to save 100% of their income for close to three consecutive years to close the wealth gap. What I add to this is the astronomical rate of unemployment of young people of color and the disruption now and problematic of the school system and otherwise the economics of going to school. So what does that portend for, and how are we to really describe the state of despair in the employment sector that has not been addressed at all, and thus far has not been a call, shall we say, as a whole for Black Lives Matter?
So on the margin, the policies that have been pursued recently have been the provision of some measure of income supplements, but not the implementation of any type of job guarantee. I think that we would have entered into this crisis in a very different way if we already had a federal job guarantee in place. It would have been possible to use an existing payroll of employees and expand it to folks who lose their jobs in the current moment. Under the terms of a job guarantee, the federal government would have a much greater capacity than the private sector to support and finance appropriate protocols that would allow people to stay at work but not be endangered of contracting the disease. It would be a very different world if we had a federal job guarantee, but it would also have implications for the kinds of inequalities that you're talking about. For example, historically, the black unemployment rate has been two times as high as the white unemployment rate. That was consistently the case up until the coronavirus crisis. It even was the case when the United States collectively was experiencing its lowest unemployment rates on record. And this is immediately before the crisis, but the black rate was always twice as high as the white rate, even under those circumstances. And in addition, the black rate of unemployment has been two times the white rate at all levels of education for workers in the United States. And in fact, there are episodes where the black rate of unemployment for individuals who have had some college education has been higher than the rate of unemployment for whites who never finished high school. So these disparities are staggering. And in an environment now where the 2-to-1 ratio doesn't still hold, the black rate is still significantly higher than the white rate. It is now in the vicinity of 16%. And at the worst point of the Great Depression, the overall national unemployment rate was 25%. So that's a sense in which we could simply argue that the black community is experiencing recession levels of unemployment, but so is the white community, but it's more dramatically etched into the experiences of the black community. With respect to wealth differences, it's not clear yet what the full impact is on black net worth of the collapse of black businesses. This might be another significant way in which the black wealth position is hardened to a much greater degree than it was before the coronavirus, the pandemic took place. You mentioned that I had written in previous work that it would take the middle black family 3 years of saving 100% of their income, something that's an impossibility, to catch up with the white level of wealth in the United States. I want to suggest that there's a proviso here. This is trying to calculate closing the gap in wealth at the median, comparing the two middle white and black households in the distribution of wealth. However, a more appropriate target for eliminating the racial wealth gap is the difference that exists at the mean, which is much, much larger and would require many more years of 100% savings by blacks to close the gap. That differential is about $800,000 in net worth per black and white household. And so that's a much more challenging gap to close. But the reason I think that that's the appropriate gap to close is because 97% of the wealth that is held by white households is held by those households who have a level of wealth above the median for all white households, above the middle white household. And this is not just because of billionaires. 25% of all white households have a net worth in excess of $1 million, but only 4% of black households have a net worth in that zone.
You talked about federal jobs guarantee. Could you expand on that? Would that mean that the federal government would prop up failing companies in some ways to obtain jobs? Would that mean direct investment in infrastructure? Would this be federal jobs? Would it be subsidies for local jobs? Could you flesh that out a bit?
So in the proposal that I've worked on for a number of years, the idea is that the federal government would be the direct employer. So this is not a question of propping up failing companies, nor is it a question of subsidizing the private sector to provide employment. This is a direct route to full employment. Every American would be assured of a job that would be provided by the public sector, by the federal government.
And what about the issues within that? I know that you've talked about a National Investment Employment Corps offering all citizens 18 years of age and above, also employment guarantee at a minimum salary of $20,000 with $10,000 in benefits, including medical coverage and retirement support. Talk about that, please.
So the numbers of the compensation for salaries is higher now than it was at the point in which we first began to develop this project. My research community is not the only group that's been working on this. There's been a substantial amount of work that's been done by economists who are connected to the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and to Bard College in New York State. But the idea that we had in mind initially was to ensure that there would be a salary that would at least match the poverty rate, but place most workers above it. We think now that that's too low, that the average annual salary has to be closer to somewhere between $25,000 and $30,000. The benefits package would be inclusive, most significantly, of the same type of medical insurance that's available to all public civil servants.
As we're talking about job creation, the Trump administration is talking about job destruction, especially for city and state employees, because they're refusing to fund extra money for the city and state governments in this pandemic. What do you think should be done about this?
I think that that's a further recipe for disaster, the failure to assist state and local governments in a situation in which their tax bases are being eroded rapidly because people's income are declining. So there needs to be some way to continue to support their capacity to provide the services that they normally offer. So I think that this is another very bad policy decision to say that you're not going to provide any resources for state and local governments.
Well, one of the other things on a more affirmative note that you also talk about is the public provision of a substantial trust fund for newborns from families that are wealth poor, and along with the passage of a federal job guarantee. Could you talk more about this trust fund for newborns and the overall thing that you really excelled in studying and revealing, and that is putting wealth back in to the Black community, which of course includes reparations. But if you could talk about the trust fund as well.
The trust fund is known colloquially as the baby bonds proposal, but it is not a bond. It's not literally a bond. It's actually a trust account that would be provided to each newborn infant, and the amount of the trust account would be calibrated on the basis of their parents' level of wealth or net worth. There's an alternative proposal that is closely related that's been developed by Cory Booker's office, and it is now a piece of proposed legislation at the congressional level, and it would provide every newborn infant with a baseline endowment of $1,000, but then there would be adjusted amounts that would go into each child's account up until the time that they're 18 or 21 that would be predicated on the income level of their families rather than the wealth level. My understanding is that this is because it's considerably easier for the federal government to get information about family income than it is for them to get information about family wealth. It will require an entirely new structure of data gathering to be able to measure wealth effectively. The Booker proposal is roughly parallel to what originally was conceived of as the baby bonds idea. I understand that the governor of New Jersey has proposed something now, which is to give every newborn child a $1,000 endowment in the state of New Jersey, but there would be not necessarily any additional amounts devoted to the fund, nor would there be any variation in the amounts based upon either family wealth or family income. So this would be a one-time uniform payment. And I think that the expectation that the governor has had is that this would result ultimately in, at the point where the young person is 18 years of age, they would receive a fund of approximately $1,300. The fact that this would be the same payment for every child means that the objective that animated our introduction of the baby bonds proposal, trying in some way to mitigate the enormous wealth differences that exist in the United States, that objective would not be met by the New Jersey proposal, not in any significant way. And it certainly would not address wealth inequality by race. If you're giving all kids the same sum of money, it's actually not a very substantial sum of money at the point at which they reach 18 years of age. We're talking about $1,300. We're not going to have much of an effect on general wealth inequality, and we certainly won't have much of an effect on racial wealth inequality. So I've argued that if we're really concerned about the racial wealth gap, we have to move into the zone of having social policies that are specifically directed at the Black American community. And that's why I've been an advocate of reparations. And I've argued that one of the central objectives of a reparations project must be elimination of the racial wealth difference in its entirety, which would require a national expenditure in the vicinity of $10 to $12 trillion.
Professor, from here to equality, reparations for Black Americans in the 21st century, your latest book, absolute must reading for everybody on the issue, of course, of the wealth gap, inequalities, and a method for redistribution, which is what I would call it, which is reparations. Are there other proposals that you have been working on that your research has revealed that as we look at many of us, the decimation of the economy, the terrifying advent of the contagion, which may go through a second wave, it's bad enough as it is, inordinately and disparately hits Black and Latino families. Are there other things that you think are imperative at this juncture to rebuild an economy with the issue of racism in mind and rooting it out with the reality that we don't want to go back to business as usual?
I think your observation that we don't want to go back to business as usual is absolutely vital. I wish we had already had in place an economic bill of rights or the policies associated with an economic bill of rights at the point at which the pandemic hit, but we didn't. But that doesn't mean that we can't adopt those policies. And those would be inclusive of a federal job guarantee. It could be inclusive of a national health insurance and a national health service program. It could be inclusive of the provision of public banking services in such a way that we could actually eliminate predatory lending altogether. And it could be inclusive of the provision of public Wi-Fi access as well as the corresponding computer technology or phone technology that would allow everyone to make use of public Wi-Fi access. And I think that's especially important in the context of a situation in which we have had to move to remote learning as a response to the disease environment. And so if you move to remote learning, not every child or not every adult can participate if they do not have access to the internet or they do not have access to the machinery that's used to provide them with the internet services. And so I think that that's another essential dimension of what constitutes an economic bill of rights in the present moment. Those are the steps we should take immediately to try to address the current crisis, but also to create a new social infrastructure that would be more protective of everybody's well-being in the aftermath of the crisis, hoping that there is such an aftermath. But these are universal programs. These would be appropriate for every American citizen to benefit from. But if we're concerned about addressing racial disparities and racial inequality, the core step that has to be taken is to address this enormous gulf in wealth, where Black Americans constitute about 13% of the nation's population, but only possess about 2.6% of the nation's wealth. And so this is the target that a reparations project should address, is this gulf in wealth between Blacks and whites. And that's what needs to be tackled. One last proviso in this comment. Eliminating the racial wealth gap will not solve every single problem that's associated with racial inequality. So, for example, I don't think elimination of the racial wealth gap will prevent the police from engaging in anti-Black violence. That will require another set of policies, perhaps including eliminating qualified immunity for the police. But having more resources on the part of Black families will make it easier for them to engage in lawsuits when the police undertake criminal activities. And so that's an advantage, but it is not the same as trying to create ways to prevent the police from engaging in unlawful activities in the first place.
Professor Darity, again, I want to let people know, if you haven't, that his latest book is From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. The cover alone, which is of the Museum of Lynching that was originated by Bryan Stevenson, is just impactful. And then when you open the cover, there's so much more. I really encourage people to take up and gobble up every place they can, any of the writings, any of the research of Professor William Darity. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and thank you for your ideas, and thank you for really being the kind of ultimate worker, intellectual, who melds race and class together to help us educate, agitate, and organize for a new world is possible, and indeed we are the ones to make it so. So thank you so much for joining us.
You're incredibly generous. Thanks so much.
To provide for your family today on your present salary is an impossibility. in this country. So many bills to pay, there is no conceivable way to save for a rainy day. In this country, avariciousness, to be precise, is why every damn thing so overpriced. Big business making everybody feel, government give them a open license to steal. Would you believe me? One night of plenty is $19.90, $20 for some baby milk. The cheapest jersey costs over $60, $200 and change a yard for silk. It's hard here in Trinidad. Lord have mercy, capitalism gone mad. It's sad, things getting more bad. Oh Lord, capitalism gone mad.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Stay strong and stay well.